Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Spencer Davis, professor of history at Peru State College. The title of his presentation will be A Look Back at 1963. Dr. Davis will talk about the major events which occurred that year as we mark the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington and the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, August 13th, and Tuesday evening, November 12th, 2013, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Durham Museum, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Mick Hale, Director of Education at the Durham Museum.
I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Davis, but to kind of give a little bit of that setup in there as we were going through my part, you'll notice that there were a lot of things that could very simply be described as, what mainstream America was white America. And you really didn't see a whole lot of diversity, but you did get a chance to see some of it, a little bit of it in the music arena as well as the sports arena somewhat. But certainly without question, the most significant change, the most significant events of 1963 happened on the civil rights front. And so with that, I will give it over to Dr. Davis.
Well, thanks, Mick. Another thing that has come up in your presentation is this kind of strange balance between trends that kept going and seemed traditional, or at least were very comforting, and at the same time hints of dramatic and drastic changes that were in the offing. And I think that's true also of what happened in the civil rights movement. Here we see one of the things that hung over the year 1963 for the civil rights movement, and that is that it was the 100th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation. And there was a sense that something significant should happen in 1963, and also certainly in the beginning of the year, a sense that they weren't certain what that would be, and it perhaps didn't look like a significant change was likely to happen. And if you were looking from the first days of 1963 and asking what would be happening in the civil rights arena, you might feel that there would be very little that would happen. There was little support in Congress for anything dramatic. Southern congressmen controlled almost all the committees and had no interest in civil rights. President Kennedy feared, really, these congressmen, Southern leaders and their power in Congress, and he wasn't inclined to go against them, and so he remained wary of any commitments to civil rights. Martin Luther King had spent 1962 in an effort to transform Albany, Georgia, but the segregationist police chief proved to be wily, and King left Albany at the end of the year without having made any significant improvements. And then lastly, the civil rights movement itself remained a small movement. It had its own internal squabbles, and it was hard to see that really dramatic changes would come from the existing civil rights movement. All the established groups were small, they were underfunded, and of course they had their disagreements. I'm going to list what are called the Big Six because their names and leaders come up in what I want to go through. The largest and the oldest was the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. It had a thousands of members. It had dozens of locals. It had a strong team of lawyers. It had the deepest pockets of any of these groups, but that wasn't very much. Its leader at the time was Roy Wilkins. They stuck almost exclusively to the approach of legal cases brought against segregation, and they had a very limited enthusiasm for popular confrontational marches or protests. The second largest group was the Urban League. Its leader was Whitney Young. He was a skilled negotiator. The Urban League specialized in job discrimination issues and job training. It had little enthusiasm for public protests as well. The third largest was the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which was really an organization meant to help Martin Luther King. It was mostly made up of Southern Black Baptist preachers like himself, but it was in many ways an office in Atlanta that was served really as his headquarters. It had less funding, and it had strong personalities who had to recognize King's place, but perhaps didn't always do so graciously. The next was a group that had just begun, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, college students who split off, not wanting any of those other organizations to direct them. They had great energy. They didn't have much discipline, and they had absolutely no money. And so they had bravery, but they had to call on the other organizations really for continuous help. Respect for their elders was not prominent in their approach. And of course, if you're young and very brave and taking tremendous risks, maybe that's understandable. The next group was really quite tiny. It probably had membership only in the low hundreds. This was the Congress of Racial Equality. It had started back in the 1940s. It was an offshoot of a British pacifist group, and it still had strong ties to pacifism. It had a dynamic leader, James Farmer, who was a tremendous orator, and they had been prominent in freedom rides on buses, and they sponsored several of those in the 60s. But it was a small and weak group. And then the last of the groups was the smallest of all. It was one person, and that was A. Philip Randolph, who had been a reformer since the World War I days, and he was now the senior figure in the civil rights movement. He was officially the director of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. He was a vice president of the AFL-CIO, but these titles really included no significant funding or power. His influence was entirely his personal record. And so if the sixth largest civil rights group is really actually just one man, you can understand that the civil rights movement, though many people were swept up in it, was in an institutional and financial way a very tiny movement. So here they are with little to show in 1962, with still small numbers and little funding, and with this great challenge over them, and that is to convert 1963 into some kind of fitting centennial. Here's the opposition they faced. George Wallace, inaugurated as governor of Alabama with this boldly defiant program. He was a dramatic public speaker, a bold figure, and for a while an extremely important person on the political spectrum. What changed the gloomy outlook of 63 for the civil rights movement was King's decision to go to Birmingham and to begin a protest there, to desegregate the downtown businesses, to get jobs for blacks working in those major stores downtown. Birmingham was highly segregated. It had a history of bombings and attacks on civil rights leaders, and this was a great challenge. Through May and June, King and his supporters launched protests. He and Abernathy went to jail. It was there that he wrote the letter from Birmingham jail, which announced that delay and temporizing were no longer acceptable, that nonviolence meant not a kind of namby-pamby weakness, but what he called a creative tension that led to a crisis and forced change. And in the end, they did get some moderate changes from the business leaders and the owners of the downtown stores, and this created a tremendous impact. It seemed like the civil rights movement was now on the move. Of course, there was great opposition sparked as well, but it seemed to change the dynamics of the year. It was a very significant episode. Here is the opposition again. This is kind of theatrical. After all, there were more ways to get into the University of Alabama than the door that George Wallace stood in. But this was theater. And the Justice Department, the Assistant Attorney General Katzenbach, standing there, confronting Wallace. This was theater, but it was the beginning of desegregating the University of Alabama. That evening, it was June 11th, President Kennedy went on TV and gave really his first significant speech to the American people on civil rights, and it was a stronger commitment to civil rights than he had ever made before. And significant. I'm sure Ted Sorensen had a great deal to do with the language of it. The two of them seem to have been mostly responsible for the wording of it, and it sort of added to the momentum from Birmingham to have the president make his most forthright statement on civil rights. However, the next evening, Medgar Evers, who was the director of the NAACP in Mississippi, was shot down and killed in his driveway. And that showed the kind of opposition there was, a presidential speech or not. Here's another element of a modest milestone. James Meredith, whose entry into Old Miss had stirred a tremendous protest on campus, and he'd had to have military guards, but he did graduate. And that was another suggestion of progress. He was a lone operator. He belonged to no group, and he took risks personally, and in this case, it was a dramatic success. One day before the March on Washington, which is going to be my major topic, there was the death of W.E.B. Du Bois. He had been a founder of the NAACP in 1909, and even before that, in the 1890s, he had been an advocate of civil rights. He'd been an eloquent and fiery and also probably unfair critic of Booker T. Washington, but he'd spent nearly 70 of his 95 years as an advocate of civil rights. He died in Ghana because he became distressed with the lack of progress in the United States. He'd been caught up in the McCarthy hearings of the 50s, and though he was revered as an elder statesman and an icon, he was a figure of the past. And his passing, which was announced at the March on Washington, is a kind of symbolic change. After the success at Birmingham, and with the president's speech, it became ever more important for the civil rights movement to try and use that momentum and do something significant. And A. Philip Randolph, for 6 months or so, had been advocating a march on Washington. On the handout I give you, I list a number of other groups that had led a march on Washington. And Randolph had been involved in four of them, at least four of them. And so the idea came easily to his mind, but he had a terrible time selling it to anybody until there was this kind of momentum. And it was only in June that it looked like he'd gotten other groups on board. The Urban League and NAACP were still lukewarm at best, but King was enthusiastic and agreed. This gave them, since they set August 28th as the date, really only 8 weeks to plan to get 100,000 at least, and 200,000 if they could, people to Washington. And so this was a staggering commitment. They met with President Kennedy in July. He attempted to talk them out of doing it. When they showed they were determined to do it, he gave it a kind of lukewarm approval, but he determined to have his administration exercise as much control as possible over the conditions, and I'll get to those later. Well, the planning, Bayard Rustin did most of the actual planning of how to get the railroad trains and the buses there. The planning went off successfully. There was some inner dissension, but it was finally agreed to. It seems impossible today that anyone would disagree, but it was finally agreed that Martin Luther King Jr. would be the final speaker. And by a quiet kind of deal, Randolph agreed to let him have more than the official 7 minutes that each speaker was supposed to get. As Randolph said, if you're speaking last, nobody's going to stop you. But it is hard to think that King was officially only to have 7 minutes as others. Well, the logistics were carried out successfully whether it was 250,000 or more, nevertheless, it was an amazing number, and it meant that this was an amazing success, and it demonstrated that the civil rights movement had a kind of untapped power, and also the fact that there was such an amazing sort of spirit among those who attended also showed the movement in its best light. And then, of course, King's rhetoric, powerful, one of the great speakers of the 20th century, sort of clinched the triad of positive attributes of this day. It's useful to remember that King was only 34 years old when he got the assignment to be the keynote speaker. He and some of his advisors had worked on and off on the speech. It wasn't very good. He didn't like it. Even the night before, he was still working away with some of his closest advisors. He took a copy and went to bed, clearly still not satisfied with it. It's hard to imagine that this was the situation. The night before, he had a speech that he wasn't entirely satisfied with, that a number of people had worked on, and it clearly was disjointed because of the several different efforts. But nevertheless, that was the situation. When he rose to speak, he followed his text for about half of the way. He made a few changes, but he mostly read from it. He then, when he came to the second half of it, which he didn't care for much, utterly departed from it. And he turned to those themes that had been in his preaching and speaking for the last several years. And as he said, he just let it flow. It was extemporaneous. It was the oratory of a pastor, and yet it hung together. It had the kind of structure of preaching. It had those biblical accents. It had figures of speech. It referred several times to the Declaration of Independence. It was an amazing act of oratory. And to think that he improvised it on the spot is quite amazing. Well, it was a sensation. And afterwards, President Kennedy invited these leaders to come to the White House. He was a little wary. He didn't want them coming if the thing had been a fiasco. But having succeeded, they were invited to the White House, and they posed for photographs, and this ended a day that was quite amazing. This is clearly one of the highlights of the civil rights movement. It's certainly one of the highlights of 1963. I want to point out a few things that we may forget, or even if you watch wonderful presentations like Eyes on the Prize, a great documentary, there are still some things that have struck me that I want to share with you. One is, as I mentioned before, this amazing event was put together in 8 weeks by groups that had very little funding. There were many more who wanted to attend than had funding to. And in fact, my wife told me that as an extremely young little girl, she, accompanied by her mother, went around collecting money to send three people from Omaha. And, of course, many more would have gone, but many couldn't go who wanted to. Nevertheless, all of this was organized in 8 weeks. Bayard Rustin has to get most of the credit for doing that. Secondly, the NAACP, through Roy Wilkins, had a tremendous impact on toning down what it was to be. He insisted that it could not be confrontational, and there could be no civil disobedience, no stopping the buses or blocking off offices. None of that. It had to be an entirely positive and sort of educational experience. And because his group had the most money, he called the tune on that. And one way this was put that I think is very good is it became, instead of a march on Washington, it became a march in Washington. And I think that captures the changed tone. And on the whole, I think probably that was a very useful change. Thirdly, there was tremendous opposition, and many of those who were against it predicted there would be chaos, rioting, warfare in the streets. President Kennedy himself had fears of some disaster, and so he brought up close to Washington National Guard units. He put Army units on standby. Judges were told that they would have to be ready to conduct all-night court because there may be so many people hauled in to courts. The liquor stores were closed. The Washington senators didn't play. Some things that sound extremely impractical and like crazy overreaction were deadly serious. The FBI wired the microphones there at the Lincoln Memorial so they could shut them off if the rhetoric became too heated. And the Justice Department had prepared the documents for declaring martial law so that they could be signed immediately if necessary. And there were many newspaper columnists who predicted chaos. And so it went forward with many naysayers and pessimists against it. Kennedy also insisted that it be only one day and that it be a weekday, lest those crazy weekend people contaminate it, and that it had to be over before dark. So it was sunrise to dark, one weekday. And they agreed to that as well. There was a famous dissent. John Lewis, now a member and for many years a member of Congress, represented SNCC. He had a rather extreme speech. The Archbishop of Washington saw it and said he wouldn't take part unless it were toned down, and Lewis worked on it the night before. And then the next day, Walter Reuther, the head of the auto workers, saw it, and he said he couldn't go along with it. And so behind Lincoln's statue, Randolph and Lewis and some others revised his speech, and they sent out Fred Shuttlesworth and some musicians to stall for time as it was rewritten on the spot, toned down. Lewis thought his meaning was preserved, but some of the more radical phrases were taken out. So they were literally improvising minute by minute in that instance. The next thing that's forgotten is the radical nature of the 10 demands or 10 objectives that the organizers presented. Randolph read them out. They included an increase in the minimum wage, job training, and guaranteed jobs for all unemployed, a new Civil Rights Act, the desegregation of all schools within a year. It was an enormously ambitious agenda, not fulfilled to this day. What we remember mostly is King's rhetoric. The 10 points are forgotten. Another thing that's important is that this was covered live by CBS for the whole extent of it. NBC and ABC tuned in later. Satellite communication had just begun, and this was one of the first things that was broadcast live to England. And so it was not only a success there, but it was a kind of media event. It was the first time that King had ever been on television for a live full presentation of his speaking. And so it was something of a coincidence that it got that kind of coverage just when he gave one of his most powerful speeches. However, even as it ended, many of those there, basking in the success of the day, still wondered what they had achieved. Had they changed the minds of any congressmen? What would the effect be? But opponents remained extreme. And September 15th, a little more than 2 weeks later, this church was dynamited Sunday morning, and four of the girls in the Sunday school lost their lives. And so for all of the enthusiasm and the spirit of the March on Washington, the opposition to civil rights remained powerful and in some cases violent. And so this is a kind of counterpoint to that amazing March on Washington. And so with that, we've come to the end of 1963 and civil rights. This is the 50th anniversary of the assassination of John Kennedy. And he is ranked by the public as one of the five greatest presidents. And many polls over the years have shown the public ranks him as the greatest of our presidents. And even those who don't rank him that highly are often fascinated by his assassination, the stark contrast between his image and the shocking events in Dallas. And so he remains a figure of intense interest to this day. And as Mick said, there have been many books published, old books republished. Every cable network seems to have its own special about President Kennedy and some angle on the assassination. It truly has a hold on the public. And there are several reasons I'd like to suggest before we begin that may be important in our thinking and interest. One is he was an incredibly handsome, photogenic figure, as well as his wife and their two children. And they worked very carefully on their image, and they were just tremendously appealing. Network news had gone to 30-minute evening broadcasts, and it was much easier to get film. And politics played a bigger part in our news, and the president and his travels could be lead stories every night. And so not only was he photogenic and blessed with a family that were equally glamorous, the nature of news and the media had changed. And then there are, of course, the questions about his last months, both his policies and his assassination. So there's plenty to be interesting. And I would just say for myself, reading the last few months, some of the new books that have come out, there are interesting new things to learn. And he remains an interesting and puzzling figure, well worth our study. Kennedy had served in the Senate. He'd served in the House of Representatives before that. But he seems to have had his eyes on the White House for a good while. His father, Joe, was an extremely ambitious as well as extremely wealthy man. And he had hoped that his oldest son, Joe Jr., would run for office. And by all accounts, he was a charming and intelligent young man. But he died in World War II on a bomber. It crashed over England. So Joe Kennedy had to recalibrate and eventually decided that his second son, John, was indeed capable of a political career. And John himself had independently decided that business and law and journalism weren't for him, and politics was. Kennedy gave many, many speeches to the public, and some of them hold up remarkably well today as a political craftsmanship and moving speeches. He worked incredibly hard in spite of all of his health problems. He gave more speeches than his opponents. He started campaigning earlier and quit later. He was rather indifferent to what was happening in Congress, but when it came election time, he threw himself into it with energy and ability. The key moment, probably, of his presidency. It was discovered by U-2 flights that the Russians were beginning to install sites for missiles, and that they would surely be sending nuclear warheads to Cuba for those missiles. And this was considered to change the security situation drastically. And Kennedy and a group he called the Executive Committee of the Security Council began crafting replies. The Russian leader Khrushchev sent two replies that weren't consistent. Kennedy, and probably with the assistance of his brother Bobby, decided to answer to the more reasonable first message and ignore the second one. And then with some quiet diplomacy and making other commitments, the crisis was averted, and the threat of a nuclear conflict was passed. And in the aftermath, I think both Kennedy and Khrushchev saw that some kind of test ban limitation would be prudent, and this was really the only time in the history of nuclear weapons that there was something like a true possibility that there would be a deliberate and catastrophic nuclear warfare. As soon as he won the White House, he began to think of a second term. He didn't want one term and defeat. And he began early in 1963 planning to run again. And winning Texas had been crucial in 1960. He knew it would be important in 1964. And the Texas Democrats were feuding. And he determined to go to Texas and see if he could bring some harmony between the two wings of the Texas Democrats. And so he planned this tour. Jackie joined him, and the first stop was Fort Worth. You could drive from Fort Worth to Dallas. And in flying, I think it took 19 minutes. But for TV and political purposes, it seemed much niftier, more dramatic to fly in. And so he flew to Dallas. He also departed from his schedule, not only to meet with the crowd, but to go to other meetings or stop to meet people. And so his impromptu stops and his handshaking and meeting, mingling with the crowd posed real difficulties for the Secret Service. And at the time, the Secret Service was a tiny organization, really. I believe I've read that there were only 28 Secret Service agents in Dallas when he was there. And of course, that seems today a shockingly small number. Lyndon Johnson, in the beginning, wanted the investigation to be done in Texas. He came from Texas. He apparently trusted Texas officials. But he was prevailed upon that this might look like a conflict of interest, that the police in Dallas might have a motive to cover up any of their oversights or shoddy behavior, and that there had to be a really independent commission to study. Then the question came, well, who would compose the commission and what would it do? And he wanted the Chief Justice, Earl Warren. Warren did not want the job. He had felt that earlier commissions or earlier assignments that had gone to Supreme Court members harmed their ability to be a Supreme Court justice and involve them in politics and difficulties, and that it wasn't the right thing for a judge to do. Judge Robert Jackson had taken part in the Nuremberg trials, and though many of us think of that as a distinguished public service, there were judges who thought it was unseemly for him to leave the Supreme Court and then return to it, and Warren was one of those. And so when he told the other justices what he was going to do, they were shocked that he had changed his mind, and they wondered what he was up to. And he didn't have much appetite for it. And his first idea was that whatever commission they had would just be a kind of text assembling unit, and they would take the reports the FBI brought them and the Dallas police, and just write them up. And this horrified others, who said, you've got to have your own investigators, your own staff. You have to do everything yourself. And Warren said, well, that's a full-time job, and it will take months or years, and it will be a second job added on to Chief Justice. But they finally convinced him that that would have to be the job. The members were meant to be men of great prestige, but there were some difficulties. Senator Russell, who was the leader of segregationists in the Senate, was an ardent enemy of Earl Warren, who had written the Brown decision. And told Johnson he wouldn't serve with Warren. He couldn't stand him. And And Johnson said, you have to. It's like wartime service. If you would fight in a war, the same kind of commitment you have to make now. And then Johnson said, and anyway, I've already leaked your name to the press that you're a member. Johnson antagonized everybody in the way that he strong-armed them and got them on the commission. And Warren reciprocated the distaste for Russell. And Warren had a man he wanted to be the chief. J. Edgar Hoover didn't want him because he'd been around Washington and had crossed swords with Hoover. And so Hoover had more clout on the Warren Commission than Warren. And the man was left off. And so it began under very dubious premises. The public didn't know this, but knowing it now, we can see the difficulties they worked under. Johnson wanted them to have a report as quickly as possible. Hoover was determined that it wouldn't reflect badly on the FBI. Gerald Ford had made a deal with Hoover that he would let Hoover know anything that happened in the commission meetings that might reflect on the FBI. And so its ability to function independently was harmed, and the members didn't come to all the meetings. Russell, I think, only came to three in the whole time it met. So it had formidable difficulties. But even before it met, the majority of the American public didn't believe that Oswald acted alone. And the percentage has gone up and down over time, from a little bit over 50 to as high as 70%. And so given that there was a public skepticism from the get-go, this was another enormous problem the Warren Commission faced of trying to win over an already skeptical public. The report came out the next year. It's about 600 or 700 pages, and then it has thousands of pages of evidence that have been gone through, and there certainly were flaws in the report and contradictions in the evidence. One of the things that impressed me as I researched was the incredible pace of events in the last 6 months of Kennedy's presidency. There were tremendous changes going on. And sometimes we kind of compartmentalize what was happening and don't realize that they were all happening at the same time. He had tried to negotiate with the governor of Mississippi, Ross Burnett, and found that impossible to do and impossible to keep safety at the University of Mississippi. He'd tried to contact and negotiate with George Wallace to desegregate the University of Alabama. That was fruitless. They worked out a kind of choreographed episode in which Wallace stood in the doorway of the college and prohibited black students from enrolling, but then, of course, just going in another door, they did enroll. But the theatrical element of it and the intransigence of the two of them convinced Kennedy that he needed to make a forthright statement about civil rights, that behind the scenes, a quiet negotiation with powerful Southern politicians wasn't working. And he made a powerful statement. He was literally changing the text as he went on, and some of it was even extemporaneous. But it was signaled his determination that he had to take a more forceful role in favor of the civil rights movement, and his commitment was to introduce into Congress a major civil rights act. The other area in which he was committed and in which there was real change was a treaty with the Soviet Union on a limited nuclear test ban treaty. There would still be underground testing, but testing above ground, ocean, air, and space was prohibited by the treaty, and the public was overwhelmingly in favor of it, and it did go through the Senate. But this had been stalled, couldn't get off the ground. The Russians were against it, or Congress was against it. President Eisenhower had had such a hope before the U-2 plane was shot down. But here, finally, rapid progress was made, and a text of a treaty was ready. And so there were significant developments. Kennedy had made his speech, graduating speech at American University, in which he announced that we would have to live with the Soviet Union as much as we disliked their economic system, but the two superpowers would have to learn ways to compete peacefully and to recognize the right of existence of the other party, because the danger of nuclear annihilation was too great. And it was an eloquent speech, and it went far further than he had ever gone before. And so there were these really significant developments going on in the last months of 1963. What might have happened if he had another term, of course, is purely conjectural, but it's one of the other things that makes Kennedy's presidency so intriguing, and that is the pace of development and his own commitment and the eloquence of his public statements suggests that much more could have been done in a second term. Complicating all of this is the fact that also in the last part of his term, in fact, early in November, he had made a key decision about Vietnam. He had already sent 16,000 American troops, and he'd lost confidence in President Diem, but he had finally agreed that the South Vietnamese military could remove Diem. They did so as soon as they got the signal. They also, however, assassinated Diem, which Kennedy and his close advisors were shocked by. Not everybody believes they were shocked, but I think some of the documents show that there was disbelief. A cynical person might have thought that was very likely, but in any case, it much exacerbated the problem of Vietnam. Kennedy had said contrasting things, that he would cut back our commitment after the election was over, but he had not done that. And so this is another great hypothetical question that is left to perplex us, and that is, what would he have done? Would he have done much like Lyndon Johnson did? Would he have tried to negotiate? as he did over Laos when he began his presidency. And so the what-ifs pile up and make his presidency interesting speculation. I learned also about the enormous gap between his public image and the reality of his life. The physical ailments he had were extraordinary. The medications he took were multiple and powerful, and I would say even somewhat dangerous. They were so strong. The public knew very little about this. And you've seen the pictures. He's in the rocking chair because he has a bad back. That was merely the surface of his problems. He had colitis. He had degenerative back problems. He had Addison's disease. And so he worked through considerable pain as president. And another what-if is how would these have multiplied upon him had he had a second term? He was able to operate effectively, even though highly medicated and often in pain, but could that have continued? So the questions and puzzles mount up substantially about President Kennedy. He was the youngest man elected president. He's the youngest man to die as president. He's the first and only Roman Catholic to be elected president. One more bit of trivia, and this is unfair to leave you with. He's one of two presidents buried at Arlington Cemetery. And, of course, I had no idea who the other is. And unless you're a true trivia buff, probably no one would guess. The other, an improbable pairing, is William Howard Taft. This has no significance, but it's one of those kinds of things that has mounted about Kennedy. The trivia, the personal episodes, the family. There are endless avenues of research and interest that radiate out from John Kennedy. Well, I think I've come to the end, and thank you very much for attending and your questions.
You've been listening to a program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Spencer Davis, professor of history at Peru State College. The title of his presentation was A Look Back at 1963. Dr. Davis talked about the major events which occurred that year as we marked the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington and the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, August 13th, and Tuesday evening, November 12th, 2013, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Patty O'Brien, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the Durham Museum, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 300 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.